Devils Productions presents The Great Deep.
Hello and welcome to episode number 42 of The Great Deep. My name is Ryan Calder, your host for the show, and this podcast series runs parallel to the music of The Great Deep album. The album, which was mixed and mastered and produced by my friend Brent Quinton. For anyone who has worked locally in the music industry here in South Africa, that name will not be unfamiliar. Brent is a very accomplished multi-instrumentalist and sound engineer, and I've grown to really appreciate his input and his perspective and his friendship over the years. And so without further ado, we are going to dive straight into this interview where we talk about all sorts of things. So here it is. So joining me all the way from the other side of the province, KwaZulu-Natal, is none other than Brent Quinton. Brent.
None other.
None other. Welcome.
Thank you.
How are you?
Well, you know, like I said, a lot's happened. And, you know, years later, what feels like weeks is years. And things carry on, you know. It's been an interesting time, let's say.
That is. The last time we were together was 2019.
Yeah, 3 years ago, basically.
3 years ago, working on the Great Deep album. And so a lot has happened in that. A global pandemic and all sorts of other things. Kids growing up, life changes, work changes, all of those kind of things.
KZN riots, floods.
You know, what do they call it? Quazillions. Is that the...
You could coin a term like that, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a hashtag doing the rounds on memes and things. But it's been really good to be talking to you finally. I know that a bunch of people will be very interested in what you have to say. The legend sound engineer who's going to talk to us today about all things sound engineering.
The legend.
Amongst all the other things that you know and do as well. I would love to have another podcast with you about a separate thing, but I think for today we'll stick with mixing and sound engineering, if that's cool.
We'll keep it linear.
Yeah. So I think what we could start off with was the album itself. And so people that I worked with, this podcast series is based off of that album, diving deep into themes and questions and things.
Okay.
So just ask you straight off the bat, what did you like about the album and why?
Yeah, I thought about that question. It's kind of interesting. Depending on my level of involvement, and I think in this particular album, I think it was more like a collaboration in some ways than an album. Somebody actually asked me a question yesterday. We were talking about post, and they've said, you know, would you do X or would you do Y? And I said, well, you know, over the years, my involvement in projects has been everything from literally, you know, putting a timestamp on a master and being done with it to, you know, sort of co-writing and playing a lot of the instruments and whatnot. So depending on my level of involvement, it becomes hard for me to differentiate what's, you know, a contribution to somebody else's project versus my own. It feels quite... part of what I would have done, you know what I mean? So I think this album in particular feels a little bit more like a collaboration between us than it does just a strict, you know, you gave me the project to mix and I gave it back to you sort of thing.
For sure.
So, yeah. So asking me, like, you know, did I like it or did I not like it? I mean, I think I would be, if I said I didn't like it, it would be my own fault. Because I had every opportunity to steer it in the direction I wanted it to go. So, yeah, I mean, it feels partially my album, if I'm making sense.
Yes,
that makes sense. Yeah. So, I mean, we've known each other for forever by now.
Yeah.
And, you know, you trusting me to kind of come alongside you and to guide the process and to have, I think, quite a lot of influence over the way it ended up sounding. It feels,
Yeah, and that was the initial discussion that we had was, Brent, I've got these songs. They're so average. Can you just like take them and, you know, maybe make them amazing and radio friendly? And that was the brief. And honestly, that's what you did. So much so to the point when I said, like, you know, how did you do that? And how did you do that? It's like you were very self-effacing about the whole process. You were like, no, I didn't actually do that much. I just, you know, did a bit here and a bit there. And I was like, no, man.
Well, it was that, really. I think that one of the hardest things for me to overcome is to start something. I think it's easier for me to have like even if it's a simple basis on which I can work, and then to work in a direction than to start with nothing. I think that's as a writer, I think you'd attest it's difficult when somebody says, okay, well, just do something. Because it's easy to start with at least an idea, something that's like a fledgling, and then turn it into something, which is what I end up doing a lot of the time. As a case in point, you'd said, okay, I've written these songs and they have a basis, and then I turn it into something a bit more fleshed out. That for me is easy because I've been doing that a while, I guess. But to come up from nothing. Also, I think it's easier if somebody else kind of, to use the analogy, you know, sort of digs the rocks out the ground and then you polish the diamonds. It's, you know, you feel less responsible as the polisher somehow. It's kind of a bit of a creative cop-out for me to kind of go, well, if it's good, it's because of my contribution. And if it's not good, it's because of a lack of finding the right rock. I don't know.
Well, you did very well. I'm not sure that's entirely true, but at least for that part, you do it really well.
Well, thanks.
I mean, on that note, like in terms of how we've worked in the past and things. I mean, we've I think the previous album, which we did, you know, ages ago, we had recorded here in a studio and then sent you the whole a whole bunch of songs, which was a lot more of an acoustic album. That was on the edge, and I think the idea was that you know, there was a cohesive whole to that project, whereas this one, it was like, can you just treat every song on the basis of what it should be? So there was a lot more diversity going on with The Great Deep as opposed to On the Edge. Is that something that you get tasked with a lot nowadays? I mean, do you get asked to, like, you know, do albums as a whole quite often, or would you say it's more like singles and those kind of, you know, bitty part processes?
I think that the music industry and the way that people even consume music has changed so much, especially over the last 5 years, probably. Albums aren't really a thing that people do very much anymore. Even if they do an album, it doesn't come across that way because people have a tendency to release singles anyway. So they might release like 3 or 4 singles and then go, oh yeah, by the way, there's an album that all these singles belong on. So I think that, like, the last time, aside from your album, the last time I did a full album with a band especially was literally years ago. I mean, obviously having come out of what we have the last couple of years, it's understandable. But even before then, you know, people had kind of transitioned from doing albums into doing EPs, maybe doing, like, you know, 4 tracks, right down to doing singles. I think it feels like we've come full circle, though, because it's funny how this concept of doing a single seems like a new thing. But I mean, that's where the recording industry started. If you look way back in the 50s and 60s, you know, artists would go into a studio and they would produce a single and then a B-side, which was the, you know, the other side of the single 45 that they would make at the studio. And then kind of like a bunch of your photos, once you had a bunch of singles, you could collect those together and put them in an album, right? And then you would have an album of all of your singles. So the idea of creating an album before he'd released any of the singles only really happened later, probably in the 70s, I guess.
Right.
Where instead of collecting all of your singles into an album as a collection, you know, a band would endeavor to actually record an entire album. So at the beginning, it wasn't like that. It evolved into that, and we've kind of come full circle now where guys don't necessarily do albums anymore. They'd rather do a single because it's, you know, with social media and online streaming, you don't need to have an album anymore. You can just as easy release a single. In fact, it's easier because you don't have to, you know, spread your creative focus as far. You can just focus on what's in front of you, which is the single, and then take it from there. Even down to how cohesive or lack of cohesive a sound is for a band or an artist. If you look at, like, Imagine Dragons as a good example. I mean, what are they? Are they a pop band? Are they a hip-hop band? Are they a rock band? Or what? I mean, they could reinvent themselves on their next single, you know, and just keep going. I think that the landscape has just changed so much. For better or worse, it's just very different. That's an overly elaborate answer to that question.
No, but it's interesting because I know that, you know, in musician circles, I think it's something that we should think about more, because one of the things I really like about albums, both making them and listening to them, is that you get a broader picture of an artist with an album as opposed to like one song. There's a bigger story, there's a bigger I just think that the canvas is a lot fuller than with a 3-minute radio hit, you know. I think that would be one of those questions that will probably evolve over the next 6 months and 2 years and 5 years. It'll just keep going round and round.
Well, I mean, if books became tweets, you know, it's like albums have become singles. I mean, videos are TikToks now, right? We seem to be living in the era of condense everything down to a smaller part of itself.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your process and sound engineering, because I think people would be really interested. I mean, I'll tell you this story. I think I've told you before. I first connected with you because of Rowan Stewart, believe it or not.
Okay.
I listened to, I think it was 1,000 Brand New Places. It was going back a long time. And I remember the first track and listening to it and going, oh my word, this sounds like Sting. And the guy lives in Kloof or something, you know. It was just an amazing soundscape. And then, you know, as you do, pulled out the CD booklet back when we had CD booklets and read CD credits. And there on the credits was his whole process, you know, recorded these tracks at home and mixed and produced by Brent Quinton. So if anyone hasn't heard your stuff, I think they could probably listen to most KwaZulu-Natal and South African artists, and, you know, but I mean, you go way back in the industry. So what I'm saying is your street cred kind of goes ahead of you. So I think what people are interested in is, how do you do that? Like, what is your process to mixing and production?
I always try and, so first of all, I think I have mild ADD. Where, like, mild OCD and mild ADD. So I think that the two things kind of go hand in hand. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, but...
you're in good company as far as that goes. that's the Calder household through and through.
Yeah, I think maybe it's a creative thing. I don't know. I think of myself as creative. I hope I am. I tried and... subconsciously anyway adopt a philosophy of, like, if it's not broken, don't fix it. So as a case in point, if you're referring to that project that I did with Rowan, that was an interesting project for him. Not that we want to talk about him too much, but he's amazing. He's one of the most gifted musicians I've come across. He obviously started playing and performing when he was very young, and he played in a band called Sinosha, which I recorded probably in the late 90s already, I think, maybe early 2000s, thereabouts.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it was early 2000s. And that album that he did, I think it was called something about a kingdom or I don't know. But it was an interesting project for him because it was all of the songs that he'd written up until that point in his musical life, which was all of it, right? So unlike an album that somebody might do today, like if I wrote an album, okay, I'm a bad example because I've never done an album, but if you had to do another album today, it would be, you know, starting from maybe a song you wrote a couple of years ago to something you just finished. Whereas if he was doing something that was a collection of everything that he'd ever written that he wanted to put out there. So yes, he did most of the production himself. And what that meant is that he recorded all the guitars and I'm trying to remember because I've done a few albums with him. I think he recorded the guitars and he did some drum sequencing and keyboards and bass and whatever, all on his own at home. And I think that we recorded the vocals in the studio. I think I recorded the vocals of them, although I might be lying. He might have done that on his own too. So it would have been a similar process to what we followed. You know, he'd taken stuff as far as he could take it, and he wasn't kind of precious about certain things. He realized that in particular the rhythm parts, like the drum tracks and whatever, he'd kind of done very basic versions of them, and he was like, okay, can you take those and make them sound believable? Because he, you know, had a drum machine doing whatever. But I would say that, you know, 85% of that genius is him. I mean, I was just kind of polishing what was already there. So I would basically, to explain the question again, a long-winded answer, my process is normally just to take it at face value and to try and understand, you know, what you're trying to say, I think, creatively through a piece. Because, like I said, what's important about that particular album is it's quite varied. I think that there's kind of more hard rock sounding things, some quite like acoustic, unplugged feeling things, some more dramatic, sort of movie soundtrack sounding tracks. So it's not really like cohesive from that perspective, like it was a concept album. So I was trying to just listen to the tracks individually and then try to play to their strengths, you know what I mean?
Right,
And then on some things he would come back and go, oh, no, that's totally not what I was hoping for. Because he DR'd all the guitars. So if you record the DR of an electric guitar, then, you know, where you take that after the fact is kind of open to your own interpretation, I guess. And like I was with the drum tracks, he wasn't too fussed. He was like, okay, that sounds good. Or, you know, so he's very, very fussy in particular about some things and not really fussed about others. I guess everyone's like that. They have their own thing that they're trying to preserve, you know. So it's always about that, just trying to hear what I believe the song is trying to say or what it's trying to put forward, and then try and cut out the things that are kind of obscuring that, and then, you know, focus the things that are moving in that direction. So I don't know, it's a vague answer, but that's pretty much what I do all the time.
And I think that you are very good at that. I mean, and quite democratic in the process, because you must deal with, you know, people who, you know, you'll have one idea and, you know, a band or an artist. I mean, I just love what you do. So I basically just say, yeah, that's great. Brilliant. but I'm sure people argue with you along the way. And you've got a great reason for the song and treating the sound and the song in terms of the integrity of what's there.
Yeah,
in terms of that, like, how do you how do you manage that process? I mean, that would be interesting for me to know.
I think that, like, maybe I always knew, well, subconsciously, maybe I knew that I was destined to be a producer, maybe. Is I remember when I was first paying attention to music when I was in my early teens, I would hear a song and, you know, appreciate something about it. And then I would hear like a certain part and go like, wow, I wonder why they did that. You know, I wouldn't have done it like that. I would have, you know, played the rhythm differently, or like there'd seem to be like a disconnect for me. Like I would notice something about an arrangement, you know, whether it be like, you know, using odd bars or whatever. And then I'd kind of get uncomfortable and I'd want to change it, you know, which I don't know if that's a normal thing that most people do. I certainly don't do that. If I look at architecture, you know, I wouldn't be like, oh, why did they put that wall there? I totally would have done something different. So I was never destined to be an architect, but maybe I was destined to produce music, because I noticed from, like I said, you know, being a young teen when I didn't understand anything about music, I would sort of have those thoughts about, yeah, I'd like to change that. But in terms of how I'd approach that in an arrangement, if somebody's working through something, and for me it's creating a bit of a disconnect, I would say, okay, well, I feel like I'm obliged to give you my opinion here. So this is what's happening, you know, and this is what I feel is kind of slightly off about it. You know, you're playing this note and then you're singing this note and you're getting this kind of, you know, voicing of a chord inadvertently. Is that what you want? Maybe you'd be better off either changing the chord or changing the melody to fit, which, you know, would sound like Y instead of X. And if somebody says, no, well, that's what I'm going for, that's what I want to do, then it's like, well, okay, touche. Then I feel like I've done my bit in, you know, putting my opinion forward. If an artist doesn't want that and they can substantiate otherwise, I mean, who am I to question that? You know, I mean, art doesn't have rights and wrongs. I think that's important. You can justify anything in any way you want, but that's really an artistic decision, and that's not up to me to steamroll somebody. I think there's things that I'll fight for a bit harder, and other things that, I mean, if an artist really wants it, then I guess that's the caveat of working with people, which is why bands generally don't last, is because conflict of interest at some point becomes contentious. I mean, you mentioned Sting. I mean, that's why, you know, him and Stuart Copeland got into a fist fight and he broke Stuart Copeland's jaw, because they were arguing about the way that a certain song should be, and they couldn't figure it out without violence. So that's what it resorted to. But that's what happens. I mean, sometimes people have got very, very strong creative burdens, or whatever you want to call it. They're really not willing to let something go. So, you know, I guess you have to gauge that.
Yeah. But in terms of, I mean, you speak there about, like, you know, chords and notes and voicings and things. How do you keep your ears fresh when you're mixing? Have you got to a point now where you kind of know intuitively what it should be? Or do you force yourself to take a break and, you know, get outside and breathe some fresh air and then come back? Does it sound different when you come back to it? You know, like an artist revisiting a canvas, you know, looking at it the next day, or a writer reading something, you know, a week later. Do you do that with your mixing process?
I think it's changed actually over the years. So the one thing that's changed massively for me, and this should have changed like ages ago, but it didn't, is that because of the way that we work digitally in modern times. I mean, I don't know anybody personally who works squarely in the analog domain anymore. Because to qualify what I'm saying, if we rewind all the way back to, excuse the pun, like the 80s, and we look at the way that final mix was done in the 80s, right? Somebody would have a reel-to-reel tape machine, and they would have that hooked up to a large format analog console, and that console was in turn hooked up to a whole mountain of, you know, outboard gear like reverb processors, delays, compressors, whatever. And you kind of realistically only had a couple of stabs at getting the mix done, all right? Because studio time was money, which meant that if you left that up for a certain amount of time, you were paying studio time for the amount of time that that mix was left up on the console, right? And as soon as you tore that down and you started another mix, you couldn't get that mix back, right? I mean, it was what it was at that point, which is why they used to print, like, you know, there'd be the mix, and then there'd be like a vocal up version and a backing vocal up version and an a cappella version and then like a guitar up version. You know, they'd print all of these two-track versions of the mix, because for you to get back that mix, A, was practically impossible, but if you had to try it, it was very time-consuming. So, you know, engineers would then make notes of how they'd patched everything, how they'd, you know, set up the bits of outboard processors, et cetera, et cetera. So when I started, that was in the past already. I only really got into doing mix production in the 90s. And by that time, you know, it was early, but I mean, digital technology was kind of squarely happening. So you could mix everything in the box, as people call it, right?
Right.
And had I realized earlier that the mix that you made, you know, on a whim, in the box, you could come back the next day and you could recall it like, you know, 100% identical to where it was the day before. And if you decided to close that mix and go back to another one, the same thing, right? So it took me a while before I realized like how powerful that is in terms of not worrying about what you're doing in the moment, right? I have a philosophy, which is that your gut is right like literally 95% of the time, right? So if you work through a process as fast as you can and you only make instinctive decisions, those instinctive decisions in my estimation are 95% right. So you should be able to mix a song, depending on how complex it is, literally in, I don't know, like an hour, all right? 2 hours at the most. Unless there's something wrong with the song, you should be able to do it really quickly. Not because you're going to get it right within an hour, but you should be able to get it done in an hour. And then you can put it to bed and you can carry on with another one, right? And then you go and listen to it in your car or listen to it a day later. And then anything that you've got wrong is going to be obvious, you know? And then you go, okay, well, I didn't get that right because of whatever. And then you go back and you just fix that little bit and you do the same thing. And then if that's still not right, then you go and you tweak something else. And it really shouldn't take you long. It's not even, I don't even think it's a case of resting your ears anymore. It's like nobody needs to, you know, sit and get a mix right anymore.
No one does.
Because you can save it for another day, basically. It's the truth. It's the truth. You really can. And you know what the thing is for me? I think psychologically it takes all of the pressure off me, because if I simplify this and say, well, I'm just going to do whatever I'm going to do right now, and how wrong can it be, because I can come back and change it tomorrow, right? Just go on your instinct. I'll do this on a track-by-track basis. I'll be going through it, and then, you know, especially with the vocals, I'm just kind of making it up as I go. Okay, so we're going from the verse to like a pre-chorus section. So how should the vocal sound here, you know? Oh, I don't know. Let's just, you know, try and put one foot in front of the other and figure it out as you go. And the worst that can happen is it doesn't sound right and you come back and change it tomorrow, you know. And if the levels are a bit wrong, I mean, obviously you can't spend hours and hours, you know, sitting, even if you had to try and mix a whole album like this, it's not good, because I think you get fatigued. So give yourself 3 hours and then come back.
Yeah, I like that. And it sort of reminds me a little bit about, and I've watched you work before. It's kind of like Jacob Collier, you know, his...
Oh, easy. Don't put us in the same category, please. Categoric, like music genius.
I have to go there just from a... Because we're talking about soundscapes and all of that kind of thing, because it's one of those things where, you know, you kind of think through... you know, you talk about your gut and what your instinct is, and he seems to work the same way. He just kind of goes there quickly, does it, executes it quickly, and seems to be able to jump jump around, I mean, certainly jump around Logic like really fast, but I think that's also an interesting idea, isn't it? I mean, like, seeing how quickly he executes things, and it's great, you know. He doesn't seem to deliberate a lot on things, which is you know what I see in you as well. It's just like, you know, chop chop, and then it's great.
I think it might be a key to like executing creativity is don't give yourself enough time to second guess yourself. You know, right. On a few occasions, what's happened for different reasons is I've had to re-record the same song, right?
Yeah.
And what I found quite disheartening is you can never get something the same twice, especially like, you know, if we sat down and we did a demo of something very quickly, and there was something about that demo which worked out really cool. Partially because we weren't caring about it, right? We just went and we put it down and whatever. And then we went, okay, let's try to do this properly now. But let's try and recapture that cool thing that we did, you know? It's like you're trying to do something that you didn't care about in the first place, and it's almost impossible to get it right. As a case in point, I'll tell you a story, which you might or might not know. So Norah Jones, let me have a look here. She did an album... couple of years ago, right, that won a billion Grammys, right? I'm just trying to Google the name of the album. It was somewhere in the, anyway, doesn't matter. She won a ton. I think it was in 2003, must have been. It looks like that was the one that got most of the awards. And the story behind that album is that her and her band had got together, and they had recorded a bunch of demos of the songs that they'd written, right? But I think they recorded them pretty well, but genuinely, they had recorded them as demos, and that was what they were designed as, so that they could basically give them to the record label and say, hey, these are the album songs that we're putting forward, right?
Yeah.
So they... went and, like most artists would do, they went and they, in inverted commas, like properly re-recorded those songs. And, you know, when they listened back to them, they were kind of like, nah, man, something's not right. Like the demos like felt better, right? And I think all things aside, they might not have been recorded to the same level of fidelity. But I think the fact that they weren't trying as hard, and this goes back to that thing that I'm saying. It's like, I think creatively, your first go at something, you're not really trying that hard. This even goes for vocal takes. I normally notice that if I'm doing a bunch of vocal takes with the singer, like normally their first one's actually the best, because you haven't allowed your brain to go to that place where it's like, okay, I'm trying to do this properly now. First time you do it, you're not really thinking about it. The more you get your brain involved in it, like the worse it seems to get. Like, go funny. Figure.
It's yeah. funny that, because that's how we did some of the takes for The Great Deep. You just said, right, so we just record this. Okay, go, lights off. Yeah, something, you know, it was bang, like it was literally 15 minutes and that was it, you know.
I think those are the best creatively. They might not be the most perfect.
I agree.
But they're probably the best, you know. So I try as far as possible, and I contradict myself, but I try as far as possible to, you know, just do that, not think about things too much, and just go ahead and.
And that's interesting, because I must ask you about Slow. If you remember that, the whole song is two chords, and that I recorded. I mean, it's going back, I think 10 years now. All I remember is that we had two babies. Well, we had a toddler and a baby. And I think even in the guitar track, you can hear, you know, the birds outside, and you can hear the door closing. I think, you know, Tammy was putting one of them to sleep or something. But that whole take was like, just sit down, oh, this is an idea. And I mean, how when I listen to it on my iPad 2, generation two, it sounded great. And then send it to you. You polished it, you know, beautifully, put some little bit of strings in the background. But did you do much else to it?
No, on purpose I didn't.
Because I think those were one of those, that was one of the things that I remember from that album. We tried, another friend of mine who's had a nice like audio interface and everything, we tried to recreate that complete with like recording at night with the thunderstorm in the background and all of this kind of thing. We just like, it just never got there.
I know, it's very elusive, I think.
Yeah,
unfortunately, because we all have this aspiration to get something done like properly, you know, like what is properly even, but we really like to do things excellently, and we think that if we pay more attention to the details, sometimes like it's going to be better. But because you're talking about art and not science, although it's obviously a weird like intersect, engineering and music, you know, cleaner or more precise is not always better, unfortunately. So look, along with that, I'm making like, you know, anything goes, but I mean, we've got such amazing tools these days too, that, you know, if you get a great performance and you want to, you know, fix some aspect of it, whether it's like the timing or the tuning or whatever, you can always do that too. So these things are becoming less and less dependent on, you know, these factors making them otherwise acceptable.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I think that we're living in the golden age of everything, basically. You know, everything's easier these days, so there's no excuse anymore.
Yeah, which is in some ways a bit daunting for anyone who thinks too much about their art.
But well, like where to start? Yeah,
yeah. Where do you start? There's another one of our mutual friends, John Ellis, who you've been in a band with recently, Major Tom.
Cover band. It's like
awesome though. And I wanted to ask you about like your musical influence. Like, you know, what's the stuff you listen to besides the stuff that you work on, obviously? But I mean, where would you say your musical taste goes to, your listening habits? Like, what influences you and what do you do?
Oh, I might shock everyone if I admit what music I listen to. If I'm going to listen to any music, interesting. I think it depends what I'm doing. Music feels for me anyway, like because I work with music and I've worked in the music industry for a long time. It kind of weirdly, it's not like the thing I think about doing if I want to like go home and relax, right? I'm probably not going to like put on music and listen to it. So I'll normally put on music in the background while I'm like cooking dinner or something, you know. But because I started running and mountain biking, whatever, in the last few years, like maybe in the last 5 years of my life, I started running with music. And I've kind of got into listening to EDM a lot, which like I said, might shock some people. Like Bob Moses and Deadmau5, and you know, it's weird, right? Because I think most people would just assume that I would listen to rock music because that's probably the music that I produce the most of.
The go-to.
But yeah, but I really enjoy like rap and EDM.
I'm not shocked by that at all, because does it improve your training times? It's the difference.
I think it's more like if you listen to something that's a bit more like trancey, for lack of a better word.
Yes.
Kind of gets you in a zone, you know. Same with hip hop, because it's got the right kind of, actually, I mean, this is how much of a nerd I am. I worked out what my running cadence was, right? You know, how many steps that I would take in a minute.
Yes.
And then I went and I specifically went and made playlists of songs at that exact tempo, so that when I was running, I'd feel like I was, you know, because I battle to run out of tempo. It feels weird to me, you know. So, you know, I'll give you an example. Like I downloaded Bomb Track, you know, the Rage Against the Machine. Because it's the exact right tempo. Dun, 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 dun. That's the speed that I run at. So, you know, I'd like find songs that were there, and Beastie Boys, and like, you know, you find a lot of like rap hip hop is that sort of tempo. Not that's a massive generalization, but you know, so I would like whole pile of Eminem songs, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Eminem. Well, now I hear you completely. I mean, now, you know, every time we talk, I realize why we're friends, because I have the exact same thing going
bizarre.
On. I drive Tammy absolutely nuts with this stuff, because it's Toby Mac, it's Kirk Franklin, it's Eminem. It's, I mean, some of the Imagine Dragons stuff, you know, if it's the right tempo, depending on if I'm doing hills or not, you know, and then you just...
I'm trying not to do hills. Perpetually.
But you look at the BPM and then you match it up and like, okay, you know. So would you say that stuff is it like I don't know what the right word is. Is it a relief for you? To have something that's completely different from, you know, like work.
I don't think that I'm good at doing EDM at work.
So, but you have done.
Yeah, I've done a bit of everything. But whether I'm good at it or not is it, you know, I wouldn't say it's my forte. But for me, if I want to sort of drill down a bit deeper, it's like, the thing about EDM that I find compelling is that it's at its core, it's quite simple, but much like a lot of things that appear quite simple, you can get it very easily wrong because it's so simple, right? It's like design, minimalistic design seems so easy on the outside until you try to do it. But along with that, it's very simple, but it's also very, what's the word I can use? Like it evolves slowly.
Yes. Yes.
So that's, you know, the key to that is it has to, like, and I find it evokes quite a lot of emotion if it's the right type. I mean, I'd really enjoy like Rufus Du Sol and Depeche Mode and maybe like sort of darker, more moody sounding EDM, even Deadmau5, some of the stuff. So it's like,
because it goes with the mood of how you feel when you exercise, right?
I guess. Yeah. Well, I mean, saying that, I mean, EDM's a very broad, you know, it's an entire genre of music, but within that you'd be able to find certain things. But I guess why I appreciate it is that it's not, it's got no, for the most part, there's not a lot of lyrics. So I enjoy music that's instrumental, it turns out.
Amazing.
So, yeah, whereas hip-hop's the exact opposite. So it's, you know, like, I can't say that there's this, you're not going to find this, like, common thread going through anything, that because I also like listening to like very old school, like funk,
yes,
R&B, soul type stuff, or blues, or, you know, so I can't say that I dislike any genre of music, but I mean, I think the music that I'm good at producing is not necessarily the music that I'm good at playing, which is not necessarily the music that I like to listen to. They're all different things.
Interesting. And like in terms of the projects that you work on, do you like to like contribute on an instrument, you know, when there's the opportunity?
I mean, yeah, and as much as anyone likes to play an instrument, it depends on the context, I think. If there's somebody else who's doing a better job, then yeah, by all means, there's no point in me contributing. It's not like I'm dying for the opportunity to, you know, play on someone's track. I've done that a lot over the last whatever. So if I can contribute and it's needed, that's great. I enjoy doing that, but I don't want to do it for the sake of it. You know, as a case in point, I've never played a single guitar note on a Ron Stewart project. because what would the point be? So I'm not needed, so I don't feel like the project any less because I didn't contribute in that way. But you know, take and by that same token, I mean all the stuff that I've done with John Ellis over the years. I mean, I've never played guitar on any of that either. I've played bass on some of it, but no guitar. I mean, what would the point be? He's a far better guitar player than I am, so you know.
But it's interesting you say that. I mean, I notice a lot of similarity in your playing. But he is an absolute beast of a guitarist and songwriter and everything. So
complete.
His album, were you recording with mics? Did you do any MIDI parts? I mean, John, John, we both know, I think, is child of the 80s and product of that kind of that old school
era,
which we love. He's got Native out now, but I think most of his stuff, are mics versus MIDI parts. I mean, what do you prefer, and how do you feel about that stuff in terms of, recording MIDI versus recording with a microphone on a drum kit or on a guitar amp?
That's a complex question to ask. is the question, how do I feel about modern virtual instruments and amp sims? I think what's interesting, having taught a couple of years ago, a younger generation's actually got no idea what certain parts of audio hardware are. And why you would need them. Like, I remember so vividly, and I wasn't having a go. I was trying to establish something for myself. I remember asking, and bear in mind, these are music production students. So I would put them as like above average. They're paying above average attention to music, right? And especially music production. And I asked them, so guys, before we used computers, right? What did we record music onto? I'm asking them, what is the medium which we used in a recording studio to record music? And they like look at each other and they look at me and they go, CDs? And I'm like, no. And they go, and they're absolutely stumped. They have no idea that music at one point in recent history, and I guess you could still find it today, was actually recorded on magnetic tape, right? They don't know that. And it's not a problem that they don't know that. What's important is they don't need to know that, right? Because these days, no one cares, right? So the thing is that, most people beneath the age of, let's say, 20, who are getting into music production these days are probably using Ableton or Fruity Loops or whatever. And the engagement that they have with audio is via software. Right? So, you have plugins now which look like pieces of analog audio hardware, right?
Yeah.
That's the only sort of reality of audio hardware that a young musician or producer will see these days, right? So asking them, do you need a guitar amp to record a guitar sound? The answer is no, you don't. Of course you don't, right? Because you can plug your guitar straight into your DI and then you can use a bit of software which will process that sound accordingly. And it will sound the same as if you had run that guitar through a bunch of pedals and then an amplifier in a room and mics it up with a mic and whatever. The end result, I'm oversimplifying, but the end result is the same. So, do you need it? Of course you don't. And I mean, further to that, it's way more convenient to use the tools that are at your disposal. And I mean, I think it's a similar argument that photographers might have had. I don't know if they're still having this argument. Some people would like swear that you need to shoot on film, right? Because when you shoot on film, it does something and you get a certain whatever. But you know that it's possible to replicate those artifacts after the fact in post shooting on digital, right?
Absolutely.
I think it's much the same kind of argument that people might have. Like, you know, I love the idea of having my guitar plugged into an actual amp, which is, you know, got an actual mic on it, and then that mic is going through whatever, and then the sound is what it is. I mean, it's kind of romantic,
yes,
and purist in a way, but it's certainly not necessary anymore.
I think that's what I was hoping to hear from you, was the romantic answer, the romantic part of that whole idea, because I think there's a lot there, and it links into what we were talking about previously with a moment that's captured in time, where you try and get something perfect, and then, you know, you just can't replicate that moment. So, you know, I think that there's something in there, which, you know, we could probably, you know, talk around in circles until the cows come home. But it's interesting hearing that from you. And I think also that certainly, the average Joe's like me making music that don't, you know, if I'd grown up 30, you know, something years ago trying to make music, like, it just wouldn't have been possible, wouldn't have been as accessible. But the great thing with, you know, with the tools now is that you can tell your story in whatever way you want. And like you say, the golden era of of everything.
I think we are. I mean, whether it's a problem or not, I guess everything has a caveat. But I, in recent years, bought a digital device called a Kemper profiling amplifier, right? And all it is really is a computer inside a rack unit, which has got a bunch of knobs and switches on the front. And what it enables you to do is to, in layman's terms, sort of take a snapshot of whatever signal processing happens between your guitar and the microphone on an amplifier, right? It does a bunch of other things, but that's pretty much what it does. So what you can do is you can set up your beloved guitar into your amp, and you can mic it up, and you can get what, you know, in a studio sense would be that sort of sound that you were spending, you know, a lot of time, effort, and money on getting. And you can create a digital fingerprint of it, and you can store that inside this box, and you can, you know, store, I guess, hundreds of thousands of them realistically. So what it's allowed people to do is to take whatever existing guitar rig that they have and then create a very similar facsimile in the digital realm of it, almost indistinguishable. I wouldn't say they're exactly the same. I think it does have slight artifacts, but they're so close that I don't think it matters anymore. But the difference is, for one thing, if you've ever recorded electric guitars, you'll know that they're deafeningly loud under normal circumstances. So you have a zero volume issue, because there's no volume associated other than creating the profile itself, in which case you'd have to record it much like you would a real amp. And second to that, I mean, you can instantly scroll through different guitar rigs. So I've actually gone and profiled existing amp setups that I've used for a long time, and they're now stored as digital snapshots. And, you know, on a whim, I can just go and recall them and record that exact snapshot. And I mean, it's opened up an opportunity that, you know, in previous generations, nobody would have wildly dreamed of. And I think there's something about guitar players, which I'll attest to. I think guitar players feel like they have to work to get their sound. You know what I mean? It's cheating if you can plug your guitar straight into a box and automatically it just sounds awesome. That's unfair, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, Eddie Van Halen and Randy Rhoads and Stevie Ray Vaughan and all of these like iconic guitar players, they worked really hard on crafting the sound and going through different pedals and different cables and different amplifiers and cabinets and whatever, you know, crafting this very, very difficult to get elusive guitar tone. And now you can just, you know, literally plug into a box and boom, there it is. So you can look at it in a number of ways, and everyone's going to have their opinion. But for me, it's like it doesn't get in the way anymore. If I want a certain sound, I'm focusing a lot less on the technicalities of how it's all set up and how to attain that, and I'm focusing more on this is the sound that I have now.
Yes.
And I can use it in a musical way, right? So we certainly are living in the golden. And I mean, that's if we talk about other instruments, you know, virtual drum instruments or keys or strings or whatever, I think the same goes for all of those. Are they exactly the same as their original counterpart? Of course they're not. There's always going to be a difference. Are they usable? Of course they are, because that's what you're hearing all day, every day now. I mean, everyone's using them. There's a different thing that goes on. I mean, referencing John's most recent album that we did, Native, is it? Native.
That's it, yeah. Not,
yeah. Look, that was really out there, kind of off the wall. It's not supposed to be like a, you know, a modern sounding recording. It's supposed to sound like what it is, like a bunch of people in a room kind of banging on things and making a noise very organically. So we obviously elected to do that recording in a certain way, which is kind of rough and ready.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it sounds like it sounds on purpose. It wasn't ever supposed to be like a hi-fi experience. We would have done it totally different if we'd wanted it to sound like a hi-fi recording. Most of those recordings were all done in the same room, so everyone was in the same space. No monitoring, no click tracks, no nothing. Just a bunch of guys sitting down and playing music. So I think it sounds like that, right?
It does, for sure. And it sounds, and it's actually wonderful to listen to. It really is.
It's very kind of raw, and yeah, it's raw and unsophisticated, I think, in what it's supposed to sound like.
Yeah. Brent, it's been wonderful to chat to you and just pick your brain. Thank you for your time. Cheers. Appreciate it. And I know others will enjoy listening to this. I've got kids knocking on the door here. They've obviously they've obviously hit their zenith, so I'll dial out here. But anything? How can people find you if they're needing a legend of a sound engineer, someone to mix their album?
Facebook, I guess. I'm on Facebook. Hit Record is on Facebook. HITRECORD.
Awesome. I'm thank you, my sure friend. You. I really
thank
appreciate
you.
The time.
Great, man. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And as usual, if you did, please like, subscribe, share, and leave a comment and join the discussion. If you need to get in touch, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, email, all the links are there in the show notes. But until next time, keep pondering the great deep.